Anyone who has to leave early can leave. It doesn't, don't worry about affecting the production. I don't have a watch. I have to take my watch
off. Cell phone, please turn them off.
That's your father. A red beard and a, what do they call it, where it's gray and white and black?
Salt and,
salt and pepper, correct. Correct. Ellie, this is for you. The middle
Can you speak in the microphone one more time?
Excuse me? I'm ready to begin. Okay. What I'm saying now, it doesn't affect what you want to record. First of all, today is January 23rd, 2017, and there was a rumor all over the world that today America will announce they're moving the embassy to Jerusalem. I don't know whether they will announce, but having lived in Israel for 48 years now, just reading the vibes of what's going on, I believe that our new president of the United States, Mr. Donald Trump, has made a decision to become Cyrus II, Koresh Hasheni, Bivlo Muvan Hamilah. God should bless him. I want to say hello to the students in front of me and to my many Talmidim virtual across the wide expanse of the Jewish world. Today is a special lecture. We're leaving Rabbi Huttner for last week. I left for a simcha. I wish I could be in two places at once, but I haven't mastered that yet. And I had to be in North Tel Aviv for the brit of my latest great-grandson, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu. Today we're leaving because we have to do a special lecture for the Destiny Foundation. They're now coming out with a documentary on the 1920s, and I have a little to contribute in that area. And let me begin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Chet Amud Bet, beautiful thought. Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. A pasuk in Bereshit. Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. Melamed Sheheru HaKadosh Baruch Hu Dor Dor V'Doshav Dor Dor V'Chachamav. And our sages tell us that the Ribbono Shel Olam showed Adam HaRishon, when he created him, gave him a prophetic vision and showed him all the generations that will follow and all the wise men in every generation. Fine. That's the Gemara, its literal translation. Figuratively, throughout the millennium, the Darshanim, the rabbis, have interpreted the Gemara very wisely. I heard Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik speak on this Gemara for many, many minutes. And what here, sit down in front, don't their seats right here. And what the Gemara means is every generation has to have its own rabbi. Every generation has to have its own leader. The language we speak, how we act, how we teach, how we attempt to disseminate Torah, to inculcate Torah, to react to the circumstances around us, dar, dar, v'dashav. Each generation needs a different type of leader. Mori Rebbe dashened, and I'll be very brief, that this is the concept that we say before the Ribbono Shel Olam in the Vidui on Yom Kippur, that who are we, what are we? Before I was created, I was nothing. Even now, I'm nothing. And Mori Rebbe interpreted it to mean, had I been created before my time, I would have never succeeded. For instance, had Rav Soloveitchik been created 300 years ago, wouldn't have succeeded. His outlook, his breadth of knowledge, his vision. No, you're created at a certain time. And you can succeed because you're the man of the hour. But the vidui continues, don't become arrogant. Even though you're created and you're succeeding and you're doing, still recognize you're only human, basavadam. The Jews started coming to America. I mentioned this yesterday in the course of the Shayur. The Jews started coming to America. The Sfardim came, the 18th century. The Ashkenazim, the Germans, the Bavarians, the Prussians came before the Civil War. After the Civil War, East European Jewry woke up to the fact that there's a golden Medina, America, and they started to emigrate. Before the Civil War, East Europe was backwards, not like Western Europe. Who knew about America? But then the rumors began that brothers are fighting brothers, cousins are killing cousins over slaves, over black people, Caucasian people. They couldn't understand it, and they followed the news. How did Jews get news at that time? The Lubavitcher Rebbe spoke about it in a Yutet Kislev Fabrenging in the early 70s. He then innovated that women should light Shabbos candles, and people critique the Lubavitcher Rebbe, it's an innovation. He said, we have many innovations in life, and one example he gave was everyone reads a daily newspaper. Today, we say everyone goes online to get the news. He says, how did we get the news back in the old country? In the Shulhaif, they went out between Minch and Marav, they sat in the courtyard of the Shul, they sat in the lawn, and someone got a newspaper that was published in Germany and wandered to East Europe. It was 3 months old, but they got the news of what's going on in America. So we innovate, we change. America was real. East Europeans started coming to America, and I'm one of them. I'm only sitting here because my grandparents came to America as teenagers 115, 120 years ago. By the early 1900s, you had millions of East European Jews in America. The level of observance was dreadful. The classic story told by a non-Jew who was a social worker but had affinity for the Jewish people, how the father on the east side of New York with a beard, with payas, and he comes home from work, and at Gate Arois, he goes out to Davin Mariv, and he says to his son, Bar Mitzvah boy already, Moshele, come with me to Davin Mariv. And the kid says, what are you giving me? And when the father gives him a penny, a penny at Davin Mariv. But you see, that was an interesting social observation. To this kid already, he's Americanizing. Americanizing means money is honey. Money's important. You want me to daven marav? I'm not interested in davening marav. That's something for the old country. I'm going to get a penny. All right, I'll do you a favor. I'll daven marav. Many of the Jews who still cared, and there were some, tried desperately, how can we wake up the generation? How can we see that our children remain Jews? That our children remain our children? An attempt was made to bring a chief rabbi to the United States. Without going into all the details, they finally brought 1887 Rabbi Yaakov Yosef to the United States of America, probably the first great gaon of world stature to settle in the United States. He was a student of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, chief rabbi in New York. His whole life was one tremendous tragedy in the United States. No one listened to him, no one cared. Ultimately, rabbis fought rabbis. No one could speak in English, no one Americanized, and you had a tragic story. The children, second generation already, are Americanizing. They're not yet ready to become reform. Conservative Judaism begins, and conservative Judaism meets a tremendous need. On one hand, there's seats right in front, please. On one hand, I have two of my students from Michlala here. It makes me quite a bit younger. That's all I'm willing to say. Conservative Judaism was fabulous because it was the melting pot of America. Ethnic multiplicity, what America's all about. On one hand, it's Jewish. It's not totally Reformed. They daven in Hebrew, right or wrong. On the other hand, it's American. Virginia Woolf can smoke a cigarette and not get arrested, smoking in public. Men and women sitting together. What America is all about. So the new generation is moving. Solomon Schechter arrives 1902. By 1915, 1920, you have a massive conservative movement. 90% of its adherents, second generation East European children who either were born in America or came to America as youngsters. But while this is happening, coming back to my introductory Maimon Chazal, a new type of rabbi is appearing in America. Yes, East European, brought to America either by their landslide, by the people they knew from back home, or they had wanderlust and they faced the challenge and came to the United States. But they're already in America 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. It's a new generation. While they're totally at home and more comfortable in Yiddish, this is Zayamamalashin, that's the language they speak at home, on the street, in the shul, they know English. Some of them could speak in English. And you're starting to get a new type of American Torah spiritual leader who can relate to the realities of the Golden Medina. And here we come. This is my first book. It's gone through four editions now. I got my doctorate on the original work. And the truth be told, that they have to cancel my doctorate today because 45, 50 years after I began my research, I discovered that I wrote my doctorate on my own cousin. Rabbi Bernal Reveld and your humble servant Aaron Rakefet are both Calvariskis on our mother's side. And to write a doctorate on your own cousin, there has to be a prejudice. So the truth of the matter is, I would submit my second work is more than qualifies for a doctorate. Now, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel is the first person. It's very sad. Art Scroll does not acknowledge him. I've written so many letters to Art Scroll. It's beyond words when you falsify, when you're intellectually dishonest. It's not just you're intellectually dishonest. It means the entire mahut of the person, the fadobnkeit, and as a mensch. I'm sorry, I'm speaking my three languages at once, all with a Bronx accent. But when you're intellectually dishonest, it's the whole personality is intellectually dishonest. Intellectually, you can be the Shabbos and Kashrut and Taret Mishpacha. It all is with intellectual dishonesty. Once it's part of you, it's part of you entirely. So Rabbi Revel comes to the United States 1906. He's running away from Europe. He was involved with the revolution there. Very interesting years. He was a Bundist in Europe. Many Gedolei Yisrael later in life, but in their youth, were attracted to socialism and what ultimately becomes communism. There's a lot to talk about, but it's not for now. He was in jail, and when he gets out of jail, he decides to join his family in America. He already had siblings in the United States, and he comes to America. Where does he stop off? The Lower East Side, the little yeshiva, Yeshivas Pischol Chanan. They discover him there. Rabbi Leventhal of Philadelphia brings him to Philadelphia. He's a gong. He's a niloy. Rabbi Leventhal, who was already Americanized, a Europeish Rav, but Americanized, the Talmud of Rabbi Pischol Chanan Spekta. Rabbi Leventhal has him go to college. He gets a master's, gets a doctorate. And a shidduch is made for him. Reb Moshe Bick of the Bronx, then of Brooklyn, told me this is the erste shidduch v'asem gemacht in America. It was the first shidduch made in America. Torah with money, the Travis family. And now he's in the oil business. And in New York, they want to do something. They want to take this yeshiva, Rebbe Yitzchak Hanan, and turn it into a proper yeshiva and attract the kids. But we need someone who's not only a Rav Talmud Chacham, but who knows Western culture. And Rabbi Revel is thrown the challenge. The gauntlet is thrown in front of him. Will you come back to New York from Tulsa, Oklahoma, from the oil fields, and build us an American institution? And in 1915, Rabbi Dr. Dov Bernard Revel leaves Tulsa, comes to New York. The man was totally selfless. All this was on condition he accepts no salary. His own family, the Travis family, was wealthy at the time, the oil industry. And in 1916 January, we just celebrated 100 years of my high school alma mater. My greatest days as a student were in high school. T.A. Rabbi Revel organizes Talmudical Academy. So, Professor Rothkopf is sitting here. What's the big deal? At high school, I can do it. Anyway, this is 1915, 1916. It's the first yeshiva high school that we have in America. Later, Israel is based. What happens here is based, Kvar HaRoeh is based upon Midrashiyah Noam, what happened in New York. Gets a faculty, organizes a high school. Then he looks at the Beis Medrash. The students are sitting, Mendlerin, they're Yudapeisha, they're looking to get out, go to medical school, conquer the world. It's a stopover, right? Until they Americanize. We got to build a real yeshiva. And he organizes a real program of study, organizes a smicha program. And in 1919, the first five students to be ordained by yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Kalnana, and I know I'm sitting here in Ordnei, you're in Ordnei of the yeshiva, there may be others here. The first five are ordained. And Saul B. Friedman, rabbi later in Washington Heights, lawyer, all attention is about Saul B. Friedman. He was the first American-born graduate to get smicha in the United States. Solomon B. Friedman. What an achievement. And now the roaring 20s come in. And by now you have a second and a third generation in America. And the brightest and best of yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Hanan are not continuing. In America, you got to go to college. It's not enough to have a high school. By the 1920s, every Jewish kid is in college. Those who can't afford it go to the City College of New York, which then was a bastion of achievement. Some of the most world-famous professors taught in CCNY. Those who had more money, Yiddish cup, good heads, they went to Columbia. And Rabbi Revel reached the conclusion that we must have both a yeshiva on the highest level and a college on the highest level. Let's talk about the yeshiva first, and then we'll go on to the college. What does it mean, a yeshiva? By 1920, American Jewry had become the guardian of world Jewry. They recognized their responsibility. World War I and all that the Jews went through on the battlefield had a great impact on American Jewry, including the Orthodox Jews. They became their brother's keeper. HaShomer Achi Anochi Kein. Yes. The relief work, the Joint Distribution Committee, and the Orthodox Central Relief, the Rosh Yeshiva in Europe, after World War I, started visiting America to raise funds. 1924, Central Relief brought over three Gedolei Yisrael to raise funds for Palestine Yeshiva, for European Yeshiva. Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Chief Rabbi of Palestine. Rav Avram Dovber Kahana Shapiro, the Kovna Rav. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva. And these great Rabbanim were coming to America, and Rabbi Revel always felt bad because their attitude was that Yeshivas Ritz Chochanan is an American institution. Vas Kenin Zay, what do they know? What level is it on? Who are the teachers? September 1st, 1922. Normie, put it on your calendar. That day you drink Ulachayim to Rabbi Revel's memory. And you thank him because you're only sitting here, and I'm only sitting here because of what happened September 1st, 1922. What happened September 1st, 1922? A boat docked. And a man was on that boat who arrived in America for one purpose only, not to raise funds, not to speak in public, but to teach the highest class at Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, what later would become Yeshiva University, Reb Shlomo Palachek, the Maitshita Ilui. If you take a walk from here to Mekaz HaRav, one block up from Mekaz HaRav, there's a street called Rehov HaIlui. That street is named after Reb Shlomo Palachek. Rehov HaIlui, Al Shem Reb Shlomo Palachek, Hanoda, the Shem HaIlui Mi Meitshit. Meitshit is where he grew up. He was Reb Chaim Briska, had many students. Reb Chaim said the greatest Ilui he ever taught was Reb Shlomo Palachek. He came to America. Why did he leave Europe? People said, why did you leave Europe? You would have been the biggest Rosh Yeshiva in Europe. But Rav Shlomo Palachek had a tremendous problem. Nishma kenim gedacht. Don't know how to say that in English. He became a Mizrachiite. He was a follower of Rabbi Reines. He taught, and Rabbi Reines is the founder of the Mizrachi. Rabbi Reines is yeshiva. Oh, how the world moved right after World War One, when Agudat Yisrael starts to function and they make a decision that anyone who believes that there can be Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel before the coming of Mashiach is a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, brutus, depraved, degenerate, devout, surreptitious, apikores, to say the least. So Rabbi Reines, he was at home in America. The students loved him. It's a revolution. There's a description in the Yiddish newspapers that Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan had an alumni reunion of the rabbis that graduated and were out in the field. And the tables they described were set with beautiful food. It's the roaring 20s. There's money. There's food. And not one young rabbi is touching the food. And the reporter from the Yiddish newspapers, there were about four or five dailies in New York at that time, looks around, yeshiva boys not eating. Cake, schnapps, soda, herring, delightful Jewish food, and no one is touching it. And then he saw why, and he describes 115 young men are standing around, an elderly person with a long beard, and he's sitting and eret and lernen, he's talking and learning a sugyan yavamat. Till he finished, 1 hour and 15 minutes later, no one touched a drop of food. It was now a different United States. But we Jews have no mazal, kamara, and open ein mazal to Israel, whatever it means, we'll leave for a different time. And the Maitshita, in his mid-50s, comes down with a gum infection, asthmalitis of the gum, which we cure today with one shot of antibiotics. This is before antibiotics, and in his prime, he dies. Rabbi Revel is heartbroken, and he now continues to look and look who will come to America. This is 1928. Finally, December of 29, he finally succeeds in bringing Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, the son of Reb Chaim Briska, to the United States. What an achievement. And do you start to understand what this means for us in this room and to all those listening? Reb Moshe comes to the United States and that becomes the goal of Moriu Rebbe, his eldest son, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, to join his father in the United States. A few years later, the Rav arrives, as we call him, and that establishes the Soloveitchik dynasty in the Western world, which continues to have such influence and such creativity and such accomplishment in our Torah world. This is the Soloveitchik family, the youngest brother, Aaron Soloveitchik. This is the Rav's family, his sons-in-law, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Gaon B'Yisrael, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. His other son-in-law, Professor Twesky, the Tolna Rebbe / Harvard University professor. The Tolna Rebbe's son, Rav Meir Twesky, Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, Rosh Yeshiva Haretzion. And I could go on and on what has the Soloveitchik family given us. And it all goes back to September 1st, 1922. So now the yeshiva, no one can look down upon Ritz. No one can say it's not a top yeshiva, a top faculty, but there's more. You have to have a college, you see. At that point in time, the 1920s, the 1930s, every kid in yeshiva, and Yeshivas Pirkei Chochmah was the biggest yeshiva, the prime yeshiva, the focal yeshiva, but there already was Torah V'das on the map. They follow with the high school, emulating MTA. RJJ follows with the high school, emulating MTA. The other yeshiva, the later, Chaim Berlin, only comes to a high school in the 30s, but every Jewish kid was going to college. There were a few exceptions. I can't go into great detail now, but some of you who have studied with me for years know I dealt with the Malachim in America, which is the late 20s, early 30s, where there was a movement that kids should not go to college. And in Torah V'das, they threw these students out. They were undermining the institution by talking against going to college. And this is absolute fact. It's Shuvit written. Rabbi Baumel, if you recall, Emek Halachar, I cited it in class. But outside of the Malachim, who were few and far between, and I can tell you my wife, Baruch Hashem, and her family, they were Malachim. Okay, so I know the Malachim up close. I can tell you endless stories. Again, not for now. But outside of the Malachim, which was 2% of the Orthodox population, every young man was going to college. And Rabbi Revel had goals. He didn't stop a little college. We're going to build a tremendous campus. And he launches a $5 million drive to build a new campus for Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan, which was on East Broadway on the Lower East Side. We're going up to farmland, Washington Heights. Yeshiva bought up endless farmland. And we're going to build a major campus with a dormitory, with a dining hall, with all that students need, with a basketball court. Washington Heights, the subway didn't even go there yet. The end of the world. $5 million, now we're talking in the year 1980, where are I today, 2018. Today is 2018. Risa, do you know why it's 2018? Because a Talmud Chacham who cares about the Torah people doesn't say one word without thinking what the results will be 1 year from now. Esahu Chacham Haro'eh et Hanolad. Don't forget it. We're in 2018. $3 million. Five, big deal. You know, everyone who owns an apartment in Jerusalem is a millionaire. But going back to 1923-24 when this campaign was announced, do you have any idea what we mean? $5 million. Three people responded and put the campus on the map, and I want to mention their names: Harry Fischel, Mendel Gottesman, and Nathan Lamport. Each one ultimately gave the yeshiva $200,000, 1925 money. With that basis, they were able to build the building. But let's move sideways. A most fascinating chapter. By the 1920s, you had Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism basically played no role with the East Europeans. A Reform Jew, mainly German, Prussian origins, perhaps British origins, but an East European Jew felt ill at ease. Conservative movement was attracting many. JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, was alive and kicking. These were the golden years of JTS. Many graduates of Talmudical Academy and afterwards Yeshiva College in the 30s into the 40s into the 50s, it ended by the early 60s, went on to study for the rabbinate at JTS. JTS had teachers who were Shema Torah Mitzvah 100%. How did JTS get its support? Wealthy Balabatim, wealthy lay people. Well, these people heard what Rabbi Revel is trying to do. First, they laughed at him. You can see the sources in my book. I quote, yeah, this man is insane. $5 million. But when hundreds of thousands of dollars started coming in, hey, wait a minute, something's going to happen here. And then many of these wealthy individuals raised a very simple question. Why do we need two similar institutions? Mind you, these are balabatim. Money, that's their game. You have now having a president of the United States. All right, he didn't rise from nothing. His father was already a wealthy individual and in Ohev Yisrael. There's a student in the Kollel, he's in Shvat Ami now, who the first shul he saw in America was the shul where President Trump's father gave them the land, and their pictures, Fred Trump at the dedication with a hat on, speaking, praising the rabbi in that shul. My student remembers there was a beautiful plaque in honor of Mr. Fred Trump. But today's president, a billionaire, businessman, money. It's not a gone idea. I don't think Mr. Trump knows English literature, Greek and Latin literature. I don't think he's ever opened up a Talmud. There's more chance today that maybe his family is going to introduce him to this, the wisdom of the Talmud. But balabatim, why do we need two institutions? All right, there's some differences. We can merge the differences. We can synthesize the differences. We can have a harmonious solution to the differences. And I want you to know, I have a chapter in my doctorate, and later I did postdoctoral research. That's in Rakafet Aaron, one of the earlier volumes. A very serious attempt to merge the yeshiva with the Jewish Theological Seminary. When you think about it, there would have been one institution, and they had meetings, and rabbis were involved, and lay leaders were involved. Why didn't it succeed? Now, this was the roaring 20s. There was money. There was vision. We could have an institution beginning with a high school, have a yeshiva. This was the idea. The postgraduate division with B, scientific Jewish scholarship, Chochmat Yisrael, what they call in Israel, Mada HaYahadut, what we call in English scientific. It would have more scientific. It would satisfy the JTS people, and everything would be Al Pi Halacha, commitment as the preamble to the Constitution of the founding of JTS says, in accordance with the oral tradition and the written tradition. Why didn't it succeed? Well, my humble opinion, after much research, and I may or may not be right, but my humble opinion, I remember I went to interview Louis Finkelstein. Little did I dream, his, you know the family, it's Normie's ex, her mother was his secretary. She opened the door and brought me in to Louis Finkel. Little did I dream that years later I would be teaching her children, you understand? And I interviewed Louis Finkelstein, and he said to me, I quote him word by word, "Rabbi Roscoff, you will know more about this topic than I will ever know." I was a kid at the time. They didn't bring me into the secret room where all this was being discussed. But you're researching. You have the archives. You have access. I want to see, when you're finished, what you have to say. Now, what I have to say is very simple. There was one problem that they couldn't solve the problem. And that was Mordechai Kaplan. JTS, if you recall, when I started the lecture, I spoke about they brought the RJJ to America, Rabbi Jacob Joseph. Rabbi Jacob Joseph came to America. He had to bring a Beit Din with him. For that Beit Din, one of the Rabbanim he brought was Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan's father, Rabbi Yisrael Kaplan. Rabbi Yisrael Kaplan was a great Talmud Chacham, a Yerupeyish Rav. Mordechai Kaplan got a good education in America, and he went to yeshivas, Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, and he went on to JTS. JTS then was an Orthodox institution, and he became the assistant rabbi to Ramaz, to Rav Moshe Zvulun Margoliot at Kehillat Jeshurun, the most prestigious Orthodox congregation in the world outside of the state of Israel. That was its status 100-plus years ago, and that's KJ today. English speaker, assistant rabbi. And then, as the 1920s come in, Mordechai Kaplan is espousing ideas that are far from Torah. Questions revelation. The whole system of commandment, halacha, commitment, comes up with the idea, his magnum opus, Judaism as a civilization. That why are we Jews? It's a civilization, a way of life. My father didn't carry on Shabbat. I don't carry on Shabbat. My father, Mordechai Kaplan, I once gave him a lift here in Yerushalayim from a Beit Avel. I was going back to teach in BMT, and he was going back. He lived around the corner from BMT. And he shows me, I was a youngster then, I thought maybe he, I probably thought he could convert me. He shows me, you see, I have fringes. I have fringes. This is his word, fringes. First time I learned the word fringes. This is Tzitzit, but he called it fringes. And he says to me, I say, Professor Kaplan, I know, but we're wearing it for different reasons. I read your book, Judaism as a Civilization. You have fringes because that's the Jewish civilization. I didn't want to tell him, I have fringes, the Vahashem Zuhalach. I don't know about Jewish civilization, but you know, the Halacha says, the Be'er B'nai Yisrael, you have to have tzitzit. But see, Mordechai Kaplan, they asked Mordechai Kaplan, and this is to his credit, you're an apikiris. Where did you get these ideas? You were from Rabbi, you were assistant to Ramaz. You preached, you never expressed these ideas. What happened? Que pasa? What happened? And Mordechai Kaplan answered, I didn't want to embarrass my parents. So I have to tell you, I like that answer. It shows he had kibbutz of the aim. But as much as they negotiated, they couldn't solve the problem. On one hand, there were members of the JTS Board of Trustees more than happy to get rid of Mordechai Kaplan. Yes, he's an apikiris. Throw him out. But he had the Lamport family, for instance. Such strong support. Don't you dare get rid of Professor Kaplan. And he was the most popular lecturer. The students loved him. They couldn't solve that problem. And you have to see the correspondence in my postdoctoral research I quoted in Lentz, where these multimillionaires are so thwarted, so frustrated, they could solve everything. They could work out the money, the division of labor. But Mordechai Kaplan, that remains the problem. It couldn't be solved. Louis Marshall, others, Cyrus Adler, and correspondents couldn't solve it. But very fascinating. There was this attempt. It didn't work out. Yeshiva opens its doors. The college opens its doors, 1928. You know where Yeshiva College began, September 1928? Where did you grow up, Rabbi Hertz? What shul did you attend? Jewish Center. That's where it began. Rabbi Young's shul. The campus was not yet ready. Chanukah 1920. They should put a plaque on the shul. This is where the great institution, Yeshiva University, its collegiate division began. September 1928. Chanukah 1928. The campus was ready. The Chanukah Tabayit, Chanukah Bayit Sheni, Chanukah Tabayit of the new yeshiva, the new campus, and it moved uptown to Washington Heights, where it remains until today, with a small branch in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh. You now have a new rabbi. The Rabbanim coming out of Yeshiva University, and I'm using the popular term because it wasn't yet Yeshiva University, that only happens 1945. It was called then Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. The Rabbanim coming out, yes, their mother tongue is Yiddish. They speak to their parents in Yiddish, but they can speak a perfect English. They're college graduates. Some of them are getting master degrees. Some are even getting doctorates. They're as American as cherry pie, apple pie, turkey and cranberry sauce on Thanksgiving. This is some achievement. The sad part is that, once again, we Jews have no mazel. Rabbi Revel dedicates the new yeshiva. The building is dedicated. A week of dedication, festivities, happiness. And within a few months, the stock market crashes. And they had raised about $1.5 million in cash. They had about $1.5 million in pledges, and the paper that the pledges were written on weren't even worth the paper. You just had to throw it away. And without going into details, the 1930s is a very dramatic story of strikes in the yeshiva, teachers not being paid, rabbeim not being paid, no money to continue going, plans were put forth, maybe delayed 1 year, do not have a collegiate program. How Rabbi Revel worked desperately to keep the yeshiva together, to keep the building open. Ein mazal l'Yisrael. But the rabbis coming out, the American scene, this is before the survivors and the post-World War II immigration, you now had an American yeshiva on the highest level with a college that had a reputable reputation, with rabbis coming out who could give a public sermon for the entire community in perfect English, and in the evening could give the Balabata Meshir and Gemara in perfect Yiddish. This is a photograph of what YU looked like and its students were capable of at that moment in time. But there's much more to the story. As Rabbi Revel Americanized, there was one organization of Rabbanim in America, the Agudas HaRabbanim, but popularly known in English, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. Its rabbis were Americanizing. And here you have one individual who represents a different world. Today in the United States, following World War II, by the 1950s, the Rabbanim who set the tone for the United States were Rashi Yeshiva. In America, until the 1950s, the Rabbanim who attempted to set the tone were Europeish Rabbanim, European-trained Rabbanim, who lived in America for many decades and were half and half, I would describe them, half Europeisha and half Americanized. It's like a Chatzi Yevet, Chatzi Ben Chorin. Take whichever side you wish, as the American or the European. Reb Lezer Silva, Rabbi Eliezer Silva, was the most prominent Rav that America has ever produced. His life story is very fascinating. 1881 to 1968. Came to America in 1907. Why did he come to America? I can tell you the real story. It's for a Hollywood movie. In Europe, Rabbanim, Talmidei Chachamim, got married with Shidduchim. All of you know that this concept of dating and choosing your own mate is a relatively modern concept. I don't know how good the concept is. I, for one, am a conservative, and I would like to go back to the old European Shidduch system. I agree with the Rav. The Rav spoke about this, and when the Rav looked at his audience and says, yeah, you find your own mates. How much divorce do you have? In my days, Shidduchim were made by families, and they had a lot less divorce and much more happiness. All right, you can differ, not differ. I come down on the side of the Rav. In my 80 years on the face of the earth, I've seen a lot more than the average person due to the fact that I've been teaching Torah on to 60 years, and I agree with the Rav. Well, coming back to Reb Lezer Silva, he was an Eloi, just like Rabbi Revel. A tremendous mind, a tremendous head. Both of them were autodidactic, basically. They never really learned in any yeshiva, just sat and learned with their fathers, with the environment, where they were. And he came into the Vilna Library. The Vilna had the Strassun Library, was the largest rabbinical library in Europe. And there was a girl behind the counter working there, and he saw this beautiful, charming young lady, and he ran off with her. No, they were gossiping. His father was a Shtat Rav, the Shtat Rav Zun. He didn't make a shidduch. He chose the girl on his own. So Reb Lezer Silva, all right, you talk all you want. I'll go to America, the land of the free. He already had relatives in America. And this is the true story, told to me by the family, and he had a wonderful, that was his first wife. She died quite young. But what a wonderful, wonderful lady. They ran off to America, and he decided, genug, enough of the rabbinate. I'm going to make a living, I'm going to sell insurance. And whenever a Talmud Chacham tries to go into business and make a living, he goes bankrupt. So the family saw within a year, look, this is not for you. You're a Talmud. Sit and learn, we'll find the shtela. And they found the shtela for him in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 1907, at the end of the year. He went to Harrisburg, he remained there until 1925, and that's where he became a gadol b'Torah. He finished every day, let's say by 2-3 o'clock, the klalish of business, what he had to take care of in the shul, and he sat in the shul for the next 12 hours and learned. And there are legendary stories. Balabatim would buy the shul, see the lights on 12 o'clock at night, the Rav Zitzton Lerin, then they would say, what an amoritz, what an ignoramus he is. We thought he was a finished product. He has to sit and learn, and this is where he became a gadol b'Torah, Bavli Yerushalmi. The Rav had no respect for this. The Moli Rebbe, these ears heard the Rav say it. He also said it in public, but I heard with these ears in private conversation that when he came to America, so he's going to give a shir, the first shir, 1932, the Rishon Rabbanim arranges it. And before he goes into the room, his father calls him aside and says, my tayyarazun, my dear son, you're going to walk into the room, you're going to see Shana Rabbanim, nice looking Rabbanim with long beards and rabbinic garb and all. Zeit nicht mispoil. Don't be overwhelmed by what they look like. Thank God they have good memories, because they haven't opened up a sefer since they arrived in America. But he says there's going to be Enoch Kleiner, one man there, a little guy with a high hat. He'll be sitting in back. From Emhat Meida, Eken Lernin. And you, for him, be frightened. He knows how to learn. And at the end of the shiur, the Rav says, replace a little guy with a big high hat. Comes over and Ayashikoyach, Ayashikoyach of Yashidav. And your Rosh Bear, Ayashikoyach. And he sticks a tzettel, a piece of paper in his hand. Oh, the Rav puts it in his pocket. He now is back home in Washington Heights in his father's apartment. He looks at the paper. The Rav said 7 or 8 fabulous questions on the shiur that I gave. So that was Reb Lazer Silva. 25, he moves to Springfield, Massachusetts, and 1931 to the heart of Reform Judaism in America, Cincinnati, Ohio. Now, he becomes a Rav, not just of Harrisburg, Springfield, Cincinnati, he becomes the Rav of America. Agudas HaRabbanim, which began with Judah Peyush HaRabbanim, he now becomes the dominant figure. From 1923 on, he is either the president, or when there's a presidium, he's a member of the presidium of Agudat Yisrael. Agudat HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. Even when the Rosh Yeshiva took over, they could not put Rabbi Silva aside. They had a presidium, the biggest names of the Rosh Yeshiva, but Reb Lazer Silva always remained a member. Reb Lazer, I'll tell you a light story, but it's true, checked with the family, an anecdote, I write about it, and everyone knows the story. He was busy all over. As I said, it was not just Harrisburg, Springfield, the 1920s. All over America. They say he would go to the airport, look which plane is leaving next. Oh, a plane's going to Boston. What do I have to do in Boston? A plane is going to New York. What do I have to do in New York? It was all over. President, Agudas HaRabbanim, Rabbanim all over America. One time a cab was speeding to the airport, and the police pulled the cab over. And the driver says to the policeman, officer, I have the chief rabbi of the United States who has to catch a plane. And from the back of the cab, Reb Lazer Silva pops up. Chief rabbi of the United States and Canada. If you recall, when I mentioned it before, I also said United States and Canada. That was Reb Lazer Silva. Now, on one hand, what was the Agudas HaRabbanim involved with? And here we have to understand the biggest problem that a Jew has when he moves to a new country, a new area, kosher food. Without kosher food, a Jew cannot survive. Now, it's not the world of today. The world of today, I've been to the end of Australia, where you think you're going to fall off into the ocean. You're in a hotel. You go across the street, there's a supermarket. Kosher food, it's beyond words. It's not just made for Jews. Kosher food, they put a hatch, it's sold all over the world. Some look for the OU and some don't look for the OU. But it's an unbelievable world that we have today. America, wherever you were, the 1920s, kashrut. Now kashrut, in America, it's a free country. You can do whatever you want. When RJJ came to America and was called the chief rabbi, right down the block, the Moskva Rav, Ravidovitz, put up a sign, chief rabbi of the United States. So they asked him, who made you chief rabbi? He said, the sign painter. Right or wrong, the sign, that's America. There's no control. Worse than that. In Europe, we just spoke about shidduchim. No, what's the value of a shidduch? Families knew each other meidorei dorot, for generations. They knew the parents, the grandparents. We have a son, you have a daughter. Let's make a match. You knew who was a shaykhet. You knew who was a mohel. You knew who was a rav. You knew who was a tzaddik. You knew who was a phony. Right or wrong? This was, you're living, I'm living in Israel so many years. I know what's going on here. Inside out. I keep my mouth shut. I don't want to upset people. I know who's honest, who's not honest. I've seen in life there are people who are kulo Torah, and there are people who care just about themselves. They play the act that Torah matters. It's klapei chutz, it's not klapei pnim. But that's America. Who knew each other? It's a conglomeration of immigrants. Where did they come from? Who were your parents? Who were your grandparents? It's like after World War II. I remember in Bnei Akiva, we had some kids, they said, Bnei Akivinix, my father got smicha from this one, from that one, this one had a doctorate. These were imaginary degrees, by and large. Who could prove anything? Who knew anyone? America? Kashrut? He says he's a shaychet. He needs a panasa. People went to shlachtoises. We want to do kosher shchita. The people who put up the money, they don't want the shaykh to just shech 25 chickens an hour. They want 50 chickens an hour. No, you got to work hard. You got to work fast. The corruption. No time to check knives properly. No time to prepare the knives properly. Anyone? Doctorates have been done in this. There's Hal Gasworth, did a doctorate. Dr. Gasworth did a doctorate at Columbia U. Fraud, corruption, and holiness. On Kashrut in the 1920s and the 1930s. More work has been done recently on what went on. You had people who had businesses, Jews. So they had one catering hall kosher. And 2 miles away, they had a catering hall that was not kosher. Now, do you recognize what happened? He ran out of kosher chicken the middle of the night when no one was looking. He delivered from the trefoil to the kosher hall. These were tremendous problems that the Agudat HaRabbanim faced, that Rabbi Silver faced. This is why he was always flying from community to community, trying to bring peace, trying to work out solutions. When Rabbi Soloveitchik came to America, the 1930s, the Rav's dream in life was to be like Reb Lazer Silva. That was his role model. Reb Lazer was constantly in Boston, constantly in the Rav's house. They worked together in Kashrut. They went as a Beit Din, the Rav and Reb Lazer Silva, and they would take a third. They went to Montreal, they went to Toronto, wherever they were needed to educate. How are we going to have Kashrut? How are we going to be able to Bahatzlacha Rabbah? How are we going to be able to manage and have... The Agudat Rabbanim adopted a law that you can't have a owner who has a treif and a kosher division. I mean, these were problems. This is what they were dealing with. So Kashrut was the biggest problem the Agudat Rabbanim faced. But in addition, you had the European Rabbanim, the European community, the European yeshivat. No one did more to help the brethren overseas, outside of America, than the Agudas HaRabbanim. Ezra Torah, the famous Ezra Torah, Ezra Steira, Ezra Torah, that was organized right after World War I, Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, that was the Agudas HaRabbanim. That was their backbone. That was their help. The Central Relief. These were the rabbis who were active in the Central Relief. When great European Rosh Yeshiva came to America, these were the rabbis who helped them, who brought them to their synagogues, who helped do fundraising for them. This was their calling. This was their goal. This was Reb Lazer Silva. These stories here of what happened in the 1920s, tremendous credit to the Agudas HaRabbanim at that time. It was Europeisha, Yiddish speaking, but to a certain degree Americanized. And I'll go even further. The world was changed after World War II. And in my humble opinion, No one changed the world more than one little individual and his wife, coming from Paris, before that in Berlin. And of course, I'm referring to Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Rebbetzin Chaya Mashka, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. And you often have to wonder, how did Lubavitch have such hatzlach in America? How did the leadership have the insight, not only America and Canada, but ultimately the entire world? And I believe it's very simple. No other world-famous Hasidic Rebbe visited America as a guest for 1 year in the 1920s. And of course, I'm talking about the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, the Riyadz Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who you all know, originally the communist government decreed a death penalty against him. There was a worldwide outcry. They moderated it to, I believe it was 3 years in exile for teaching Torah. And within a few months, they kicked the Rebbe out. They needed foreign currency, and too many countries were complaining. They kicked the Rebbe out. He wound up first in Riga, afterwards in Warsaw. From Warsaw, he's rescued to America in 1940. He came to America for one full year, fundraising to have money so that Lubavitch could keep the flames of Torah going in the Soviet Union. I need not tell you the story of Lubavitch, the Mesirat Nefesh, the many that were executed, that were exiled, including the seventh Rebbe's own father, Reb Levi Yitzchak, who died in exile. What a story. The Rebbe needed money. Who helped him? They go to Sarabanan. Who was the Rebbe's greatest help? There's a picture in the Silva era of Reb Lazar Silva with the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. 1929, the United States of America. And if you did not have, if you would not have had the Agudat HaRabbanim, who would there be to help Reb Lazar? At least they were organized, they had connections, they knew each other, they had conventions, and they could put helping the Rebbe on the map. And here I'll tell you an interesting story. Just, it captures the end of the era, the sadness, the depression. I have very good friends who were born Lubavitchers. Their grandparents were very helpful to the sixth Rebbe, both in 28-29 and afterwards when he comes back in 40-41. And they tell the story right before the Rebbe left to go back to Europe. There was a farewell dinner on the west side of New York, Upper West Side, and heavy money was being pledged. The Rebbe is now leaving, but he wants to know there'll be money coming in. And my friend's grandfather and his great uncle both pledged heavy money. They were well-to-do people. And his grandfather went the next day and sold off stock to pay the Rebbe. His brother said, "Uncle, what are you doing? You don't have to give it to the Rebbe immediately. We pledged to pay it out over the next 3 years." And the other brother, my friend's grandfather, answered him, said, "Look, the Rebbe is leaving. The Rebbe needs money. The Jews need help in the Soviet Union. The Rebbe says the more money, the more he can accomplish, the more Jews he can keep Jews, the more Jews he can buy out. I'm giving it to him right now. I don't want to pay it out." Sold the stock, did very well, paid the Rebbe. A few weeks later, the market crashed, and the other brother was left basically penniless. All his beautiful investments overnight. Such people were selling apples on the streets of New York, if you know about the Depression. So you see, that's the Rebbe money. He was there. He accomplished. Who helped him? The Agudas HaRabbanim. Now, let me go one step further. The Agudas HaRabbanim at that time was very, very integrated on yeshiva and yeshiva college scene. There was no other advanced yeshiva in America. This was the only game in town. It's the 1920s. Their own sons went to yeshiva, yeshiva college. Many of them became rabbanim. Some of them later went on to medical school. Not all their sons remained observant. America, the assimilation, the problems of the Western world haunt us until today. It's nothing new. But in the 1920s, I can tell you one story that I know with these ears. I heard it from the people involved. The man who was the executive secretary of the Agudas Rabbanim helped me immensely in my research on the Silver Era, Rabbi Yaakov Hellerstein. He lived on around the corner from me in his old age, came back to Israel, he was a Palestinian Bamakar, came back to Israel in his old age, lived on the Chol Palmach. I taught his granddaughter in Michlava, and he was the secretary. And he told me, his son went to medical school, and one of the real heavyweights in the Agudat HaRabbanim, his son went to medical school. Mr. Hallerstein's son sat at a little table, opened up the package he brought from home, and ate what his mother gave him to eat. The rabbi's son, Hutgegessen, glat tafis, pure treif. So that was America. That's the impact it had. They didn't succeed with all their children. But Reb Lazer Silva, his son, Reb David Silva, David Leib Silva, was a Talmud of the yeshiva, was a Talmud of the Mechita, was a Talmud of Rabbi Revel, was a Talmud of Reb Meisher Soloveitchik. His son later succeeds his father in Harrisburg, where he remained throughout his life. I don't think there's any other Rav in America who went to a shteller in his mid-20s and remained there well into his 80s and 90s, Reb David Leib Silva. And you could see he had the Ehrlichkeit of his father, had the decency of his father, but totally Americanized. His native language already was English. Spoke Yiddish perfectly, but at home, English. That's yeshiva, yeshiva university later. Agudas HaRabbanim felt they controlled the yeshiva. When you studied for smicha in the 1920s, the 1930s, the Rabbanim who tested you were not only the outstanding teachers in what we call YU today, REITs, not only the outstanding, not only Rabbi, not only Reb Meisher, Reb Lazer Silva, Reb Yisrael Rosenberg, Reb Dov Aryeh HaKohen Leventhal, the Rabbanim, Ramaz Margolis, Yosmicha had many signatures, and the Agudat Rabbanim was playing a major, major role in what was going on with the yeshiva and yeshiva college. It was the only act in town, and they felt this was our baby. We have to guide them. We have to keep on top of the ball game. We have to see what's happening. And I want to add another thought. This certainly comes to the fore after World War II and continues until this very moment as I record, as I speak, and give the little knowledge I have to you. You see, until the college opened, there was never any opposition to the concept of yeshiva and having a high school and all that goes with it. Never any opposition. Why? Because everyone knew it's America. Everyone knows you have to go to high school. And a high school, there's nothing provocative there. You go to high school, teach you mathematics, teach you the English language, teach you sociology, social studies, I should say, citizenship. What do you learn in high school? Everyone can have a high school. Satmar has a high school today. Lakewood has high schools today. Everyone goes to high school. But college is a totally different concept. And here, you get involved, what does it mean to have a college? I'll use the Rav's terminology. Do you want a Catholic college or do you want a proper college? What's a Catholic college? I grew up in a neighborhood that was one-third Jewish, one-third Irish, one-third Italian. Irish and Italians, all Catholics. All Catholics. My neighbors were Catholics. My father once showed my neighbor a Sansino volume that I had in the house. It was probably prophets, Yeshayahu, Yeheskel. She couldn't look at it. Oh, I have to ask my priest if I'm allowed to look at it. And my father was so, couldn't understand that volume from the Bible. Ah, the Catholics have an index. Thought control. You don't have total freedom, at least in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, 50s, 60s. I don't know, Catholicism today is Reformed Judaism. It's a different reform, a different religion. They meet on Friday. It's a different religion than the one I know. But a Catholic college means thought control. You're going to have a course? Who's going to teach it? Is he religious? Is he from? What kind of course is this? What are you going to study? Greek mythology? Read about the gods? Murder, plunder, rape, seduce, rob, steal, kill. What do you have in college? Jewish history. Going to study about reform, conservative, apikarsim, mechalalei Shabbos, ochlein levitim treifet, boil bilat asurat. We have many terms to describe Jews who don't walk in a Torah path. What are you going to teach? These are delicate questions. Psychology? Freud? His wife was a granddaughter of Chacham Bernays. He wouldn't let her light Shabbos candles, according to the memoir literature. What are you going to teach? And you see, once you have a college, the Agudas Rabbanim was very worried. What's this? Open sesame? Every type of apikursis. This is not the yeshiva we knew. The Agudas Rabbanim, no one went to college. At least 99% of the Rabbanim had not gone to college. And they were very upset, cautious. Not, I wouldn't say upset, but cautious. What's going to be? And this remained a constant source of consternation and tension beyond the 1920s into the 1930s and the 1940s. And this will explain to you why in the early 40s, when Yeshiva has the tragedy that its two leading figures die within 6 weeks of each other. Rabbi Rebbe was ill, but Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik was in perfect health. And Rabbi Rebbe's December 2nd, 1940, Reb Moshe is January, I believe, 31st, 1941. Within eight weeks, both are gone. And the Agudas HaRabbanim wants to take over the yeshiva. Tremendous, tremendous machloket. They're worried what will be. And on the other hand, the student body, could you imagine opposition to Mori Rebbe, to the Rav? We don't want him as Rosh Yeshiva. He's from the Agudas Rabbanim. He's from the old type of rabbis, the fanatics. It was unbelievable what went on. But you see, this type of worry and this type of opposition and this type of consternation and this type of fear, this phobia, already in 28, 29, it's beginning. And you soon have real problems. For instance, and this is a problem that lives on until today. In the early 30s, Rabbi Rebel is desperate to raise money. How is he going to raise money? And they give honorary degrees 1 year to Albert Einstein and 1 year to Herbert Lehman, the famous governor of New York, the famous senator. both Jews. Tell me, can anyone show me Albert Einstein or Herbert Lehman's tefillin? Right or wrong? Anyone, the tefillin? Can anyone show me the kashering board on which their wives kashered the meat, the chicken, that those days you kashered at home? Can anyone show me the kashering board? Who are you honoring? You're holding up to yeshiva, Torah, Orthodox Judaism. You're finally on the map. And who are you honoring? Albert Einstein? Herbert Lehman? Some billionaire who made money? Big businessman? Michael Shabbos? You see, these are problems that were encountered already. 28, 29, Revel, what's going on? What will be? What is the image? How do we guide the ship in the modern world, the world in which we live? And all this, the roots go back to the 1920s. There was a tremendous machloket. I write about it in Revel, when they hired a Voloshiner yeshiva graduate who was totally Americanized, Harris Zelig. Harris, that was the name he went by, not Harris Zelig. And he's reaching out to the masses for money. And how did Yale begin? How did Harvard begin? How did Princeton begin? They were all theological schools. What will be yeshiva college is beginning as a yeshiva and will turn into a magnificent college. Well, what is that saying? The centrality of the yeshiva will be lost. Tremendous machloket. Rabbi Revel rebuked him. Then there was another problem. You had a fundraiser. It's amazing. Sata d'yarechatu. It's one world. It constantly repeats itself. If you know what's going on today in Tzva Hagana Yisrael, in the Israeli Defense Forces, I would get up and give a lecture. Your problem, we had it in the 1920s. Had a big public fundraiser and an opera star, Roberta Peters. That's the name she went by, I believe. She just died, the opera star. New Jewish woman. She's singing in public. Kol Be'isha Erva. How do you have a Hanukkah dinner and one of the people entertaining is a woman singing? No, the Israeli Defense Forces. Here you want Haredim in the army and Chadalim in the army. And here you're going to have women singing from these Defense Force entertainment troupe. Right or wrong? Hasn't this been headlines? These were headlines in the 1920s as well. Fascinating. And one other question, and I'll end off. Fascinating question. That once again haunts us until today. Here you have Torah on the map in the United States. Torah that can reach out in the Western world. Millions of Jews already. 3 million, 4 million Jews. How many are observant? What is our attitude towards reform and conservative? This question comes to the fore. The Europeisha Rav of the Agudas HaRabbanim had nothing in common with a reform rabbi, with a conservative rabbi. Two different worlds. But the graduates of Reitz and of Teira Vidas as well, and RJJ, later Chaim Berlin graduates, they're out there all over America. There's no Orthodox rabbi within 50 miles. Their only colleague is a conservative rabbi from the temple. They have a lot in common. They speak English. They care about having Jews continue being Jews. They're concerned with Palestine and the nascent Zionist movement. They're concerned with their brethren in Europe. Where do you draw the line? And this problem already comes up. Late 20s, early 1930s. Boston, the Rav already is there. Graduate of the yeshiva right from this period, Jacob Agus, very famous name. And he belongs to the board of rabbis in Boston with reforming conservative rabbis. Oh, was there an outcry? Yeshiva's caught right in the middle. Rabbi Revel, the Rabbanim from Gudis HaRabbanim are putting tremendous pressure on him. How do you allow your graduate to sit with reform and conservative rabbis? You got to remember, if you sit with reform and conservative, and I've been involved with my own eyes. I once helped out the OU. There was a big convention of the leaders of the Jewish agency. And I was, each hotel, I didn't know what the story was until afterwards. Each hotel, this hotel, Orthodox rabbi. This hotel, Reform rabbi. This hotel, Conservative rabbi. This hotel, Lubavitcher representative. And the OU, Rabbi Moshe Kripke, went then at the OU, asked me, please, we have a slot for an Orthodox rabbi in this hotel. We want you to represent us. So I figured, all right, I'll go to the hotel for Shabbos with Malka. We'll have a good time, see what's what. I still haven't recovered from that Shabbat. I davened, I told you, Shabbos began, it was November, Shabbos began at the 5 o'clock, 4:30. I davened the minyan in the hotel, the Sfatic minyan, fine, good. And the ballroom opens for the grand Shabbat meal at 7 o'clock. I sat in the hallway, there were lights, I'm learning Gemara, no problem. And 5 to 7, Malka and I start to walk to the ballroom, whatever it's called, the dining room. And as we're walking there, there is a big room, and 200 women are lighting Shabbos candles at the end of the service. It's beyond words, beyond words. Shabbos began 2.5 hours earlier. Reform. Then I have to sit. They're saying the guy, the conservative, I don't know what he was, gets up. I'm very happy that this evening we have real pluralism. We have an Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Roth, Rakefet, I was already, of course. We have a conservative rabbi, a reform rabbi, a Reconstructionist, and we have a Lubavitch rabbi. I never knew that Lubavitch was a different branch of Judaism than Torah Hashem. But, I mean, these are really delicate questions. I need not tell you how these questions repeat themselves much later on the American scene following World War II. So you see, the 1920s represents, on one hand, the birth of an American orthodoxy that can function, struggle, and even succeed on the contemporary American scene. On the other hand, it's still an orthodoxy that has very heavy roots in Eastern Europe. Yiddish, anyone who grew up in America at that time and lived in a Jewish neighborhood, whether he was a Jew or a Gentile, he spoke Yiddish. All of you know when the Secretary of State, at the time when Shamir was Prime Minister, he was an Afro-American, well, Colin Powers, right? Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L, I believe he spelled it. So when he arrived the first visit to Israel, Shamir is at the airport, the plane lands, and honor God, you know what you do when a great, an important person is arriving, and our prime minister moves forward to greet him, and the Secretary of State of the United States says, Shalom Aleichem, was macht der Yid? And Shamir, whose native language was Yiddish, almost fainted. He sees a non-Jew, an Afro-American. Wie kommt das Sachse that in Yiddish? How do you know Yiddish? Oh, I grew up in the Bronx. I delivered furniture on Findlay Avenue. That was where the store was, I believe. He was a Shabbos guy. And, all right, it's beyond words. The Yiddish, we couldn't get out of our blood system. So you have to understand, the 1920s, it's Chatzi Yevit, Chatzi Ben Chorin, if you want to refer it to that in that way. You can call it Chatzi Shabbat, Chatzi Chol, but you were caught at a very critical period. World War I is over, the war pinned, all wars is over. There's no more massive immigration to America after 1921, 1922. That ended with the Johnson Act, I believe it's called. And there were many Jews in America who worried and cared what will be tomorrow, what will be with our youth. And you see it, yeshiva and yeshiva college, the Agudas HaRabbanim, the interlocking at that time, these were the two hearts of the Torah civilization in the United States. And no two people played a greater role than Rabbi Dr. Bernard or Dov Revel and Rabbi Eliezer Silva. And I want to end off bringing you up to date. These two people, it's not just that they succeeded, but they are such a role model for us. Ein davar omeid keneged haratzon. And when we study Torah, and we who are leaders and rabbanim and creating rabbanim and lay people who care, it's beyond words what you can accomplish. And I want to hold up just one example, and then we'll come to Rabbi Silva. Could you imagine in 1906, 1905, I believe it was 1906 when he arrived, Bernard Revel, Dov Revel, is coming through customs, arriving in the United States, frightened, worried, what will tomorrow bring? The lechais learn in English. How quickly will I learn English? How good will my English be? So many questions, so many doubts. Could you imagine if someone tapped him on the shoulder and said, Reb Dov, Chatnish Kaimeda, don't be afraid. In 1986, 80 years from now, the American postal system is going to issue a stamp with your picture on it. And here I hold the invitation to the unveiling ceremony of the United States commemorative stamp design in honor of Dr. Bernard Revel, first president of Yeshiva University. And if you're familiar with the stamp, it's a $1 orange stamp in memory of Dr. Revel. And that stamp became a collector's item. Can anyone tell me why? The person who designed it was Jewish. And without permission, he placed a Magen David in Rabbi Revel's beard. If you take a magnifying glass and look at the stamp, you will see the Magen David. And unfortunately, he was fired for doing it. But imagine you come through a greenhorn and so many years later, there's going to be a stamp in your honor. Reb Lezer Silva, here was a man, ran away from Europe, came to the United States. The rabbinate, all that goes with it. By the way, both Rabbi Revel and Rabbi Silva were selfless when it came to money. And Rabbi Silva, ultimately the shul had to give the salary to his wife because he could walk home from the shul with an envelope with $200 in cash in the envelope. And a person came to him with a sob story, he's marrying off a daughter, Hatnish Kangelt, he has no money. He could give the person the envelope and come home with nothing. So ultimately, they had to give the salary to his wife. His first wife, his second wife, he married she had been president of the sisterhood, and she took very good care of him. He never ate in anyone's home. The only home he ever ate in was the Brisker Rav's home. He had studied in Brisk. So Revelville, he ate in his home. Outside that, he didn't eat in any home. Wherever he went, she would prepare for him bags of food marked Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And I hate to tell you, even in Mori Urebi's home, I heard unbelievable stories from the family, how he would open up his bags, but then he would ask for a spoon. And the Rebbetzin, who was very upset with him for that practice, said, Reb Lezer, If you don't trust my kashrut, how can you ask for a spoon? You follow? Untvida'ah. Either you eat, you can't. But if you don't trust, how could you ask for a spoon? There are other stories, but I don't want to publicize some of the others. They're too sharp. But Reb Lezer, here was a man fought, battled, created, and he was zeicher to many yotzei halatzav, b'nei Torah, in the full sense of the word. And particularly as a religious Zionist who believes that every Jew who cares about Torah walking the face of the earth should be living in Israel, I can tell you I have great nachat. His son is a Rosh Yeshiva Ram in Yeshiva Kerem B'Yavna, Reb David's son, it's a grandson, Reb Aaron Silva, married to my student from Mechala, Shoshana Freudenstein. I have great nachat from them. His grand, Reb David's daughter, the granddaughter of Reb Lezer Silva, is married to the Sfadik Rav of Bat Yam, Rav David Chai Kohen, one of the leading lights in the Merkaz HaRav world of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. That is her husband. There is another granddaughter here who has been very big in the Misrat HaMishpatim, and she won many awards. I write about her in the introduction. For the laws with Israel, with our ability to stop bringing in women for illegal purposes. And she's the one, more than anyone in the Ministry of Law, who was able to come up with the laws that now have won praise from the entire civilized world. So Baruch Hashem, very little of Rabbi Revel's family lives on. He had no children to marry. His two sons never married. There are no direct descendants. When I was assigned the doctorate by Rabbi Bernard Revel, Rabbi Bernard Lander, Talmud of Rabbi Bernard Revel, Rabbi Lander broke down and cried and says to me, "Arnold, do a good job, because this will be my Rebbe's monument. There are no banim uvenei banim." Reb Lezer Silva, on the other hand, perhaps was more fortunate, and he was zeicher to many banim uvenei banim, oiskim b'Torah u'mitzvah. So let me end off with I have a lot of freebies here. This is beautiful material on Talmidim of Tomchei Tamimim, Chabad, who wound up in Shanghai. And there's wonderful, wonderful material here. This is Mochach of a week ago on youth. People under 35, I think, is the dividing line in the Mizrahi world, what we used to call Mizrahi today, by the Yehudi world, Torah Tzioni world, who are coming up in ranks for the future. I went through it, I enjoyed it immensely, had a little bit heartache because you'll see here there's a Ramaz graduate who winds up in partnership with Minyanim, and that's what she's talking about. It's not Rakefet's cup of tea, but it's a very interesting issue. Here, what do you think these glasses are worth? Okay. Sold at auction. Chazonish's glasses will be rotating display at 3 Jewish-owned optical stores. And wow, what did they sell it for? $17,000. Chazonish's glasses. What a... Kol hakavod, kavod ha-Torah. Here's the latest issue of Jewish Action. It's a wonderful issue, and it has a very sensitive section on navigating life transitions. People who marry, death, divorce, and I have to say I was very moved by some of the stories, and in general it's just a fine, beautiful issue. And as someone who remembers Orthodoxy from the 1930s already, if you read my seventh book, you know that I talk about my pigeon Haben, let that suffice. And someone who has researched Torah way earlier than the 1930s. I'm happy that Sachiti Lirot, where we are today, Ashrenu Shesachinu. Next Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, I pick up exactly where I left off, and we're dealing with who is a Jew according to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Next Monday, I come back to Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, and no one will be bored during that lecture. We begin with Rabbi Jerry Blau, Yosef Blau, vis-a-vis Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, as you will see. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.